I don't see any enough money budgeted to manage fish and game resources on federal lands.
Alaska's tribal leaders gather in Washington, D.C. for the Tribal Nations Summit. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a peek into the USGS Walrus Diaries.
We saw them making these extraordinary trips where they would travel far offshore. So this is a very novel behavior. Basically, they're commuting to get to their groceries.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Quality Inn and Suites on Spinard, providing lodging for Medicare patients in Anchorage with a 24-hour airport shuttle and a hot continental breakfast. Reservations at 800-221-7550. Enroll now and get a career in less than a year in refrigeration, marine oiler, heavy equipment, or welding. Additional training programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January. This message sponsored by Avtech.
The FBI says an Anchorage barista who disappeared in February was sexually assaulted, strangled, and dismembered. The suspect in Samantha Koenig's death, Israel Keyes, died in an apparent suicide earlier this week. In the most detailed account yet of what happened to Koenig, authorities say Keyes told them he strangled the 18-year-old and left her body in a shed outside his Anchorage house until he returned from a cruise. Keyes dismembered Koenig's body and disposed of the remains in a frozen lake north of Anchorage. He was arrested in Koenig's death in March in Texas after using her stolen debit card at ATMs in several states. After his arrest, Keyes confessed to killing Koenig and at least seven other people across the country over the past decade. Alaska Native leaders are in Washington, D.C. for the White House Tribal Nations Conference. As APRN's Peter Granis reports, they're using the time to voice concern over federal mismanagement.
This was the fourth annual Tribal Nations Conference, something President Barack Obama made light of in his remarks.
Now, 3 years ago, I was proud to see that this conference was the largest gathering of tribal leaders in our history. And back then, an event like this was rare. Today, it's gotten a routine.
Mr. Obama used the day to highlight what he considers to be his administration's successes in Indian country.
We focused on justice and tribal sovereignty. Longstanding legal disputes like the Cobell case have been resolved. I signed into law the Tribal Law and Order Act, which is helping to fight crime. These are all important steps, but we've got more work to do. With domestic violence so prevalent on reservations, we're pushing Congress to restore your power to bring to justice anyone, Indian or non-Indian, who hurts a woman.
But not everyone in attendance was as willing to tally a list of administration successes.
I'm one of those that have been around long enough that I'm not going to expect the world to change today.
That's Ed Thomas. He's the longtime president of the Tlingit Haida Central Council. He says subsistence is the highest priority for tribes in Alaska. The federal government oversees the subsistence programs, and Thomas worries it's shirking a key responsibility to manage the populations of fish and game.
And we have not seen good movement from the administration on fixing those problems. From my perspective, I'm a manager-type person. I don't see enough money budgeted to manage fish and game resources on federal lands.
The Tribal Nations Conference is a gathering of representatives of each of the 566 federally recognized tribes. There's a lot of pomp and circumstance in public view, and the crux of the day happens behind closed doors. The attendees break into groups to discuss issues that matter most to their people. Thomas says his session focused on the government-to-government relationship. And he brought up the money his people are owed for indirect costs, the operating costs of running an Indian Health Service site or a Bureau of Indian Affairs program.
If you got a contract, it takes a certain amount of money to manage that contract because you have facilities, you have executive direction, all those things.
Thomas says that despite any concrete agreements at the conference, he's optimistic the government will resolve any issues because, he says, it's conferences like these that show they're still willing to talk. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Walruses face an uncertain future as sea ice disappears from the Arctic Ocean, but two recent scientific papers shed some light on their plight. One study looks at where walruses forage in the summer as the ice retreats far off the continental shelf. The other predicts how the disappearing sea ice could impact walrus population numbers in the years ahead. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Every summer, U.S. Geological Survey biologist Tony Fischbach gets a glimpse of a world few people get to see. On a small skiff in the Chukchi Sea, he and a team of scientists look for groups of walruses resting on the sea ice. A USGS videographer went along with Fischbach's team this summer and recorded this audio. The scientists wear all white to blend in with the landscape and approach slowly with the motor running low. Then Fischbach aims and shoots his crossbow, embedding a satellite tag in the thick walrus skin. It's an action Fischbach has repeated hundreds of times over the last 5 years. Once the tags are in place, he can monitor the walrus's movements for about 2 months. Those walrus diaries, as Fischbach calls them, are summed up in a research paper published last month.
Based on this, we can really quantify their utilization of the Chukchi Sea, identify areas that are the focus points of their foraging, and identify areas that really aren't used. So that can be really useful for people who are wanting to make environmental plans.
Shell Oil is using the information. The company's main exploratory site in the Chukchi Sea right now, the Berger Prospect, is on the southern boundary of Hannah Shoal, a hotspot for walrus foraging in July and August. Marine mammal observers with the company reported seeing 8,700 walruses from its drilling and support ships this summer. But Shell says there were no significant disturbances or injury to the animals. Scientists expected walruses to be hauled out on shore by the time Shell began exploratory drilling in September, as they have in recent low ice years. But this year, Fischbach says the animals found enough sparse ice to rest on, even after the main pack ice retreated far north.
Some of these pieces of ice, we call them sparse, but they can be substantial, enough to cause trouble for ships that are trying to operate in the area, and enough to provide a platform for these walruses to utilize.
Starting in 2007, when the ice disappeared, the walruses began hauling out on Alaska's north coast. But when the walruses are on shore, they don't have access to the rich food supplies they're used to in the ocean. So Fischbach's walrus diaries have revealed walruses hauled out on shore are willing to swim huge distances to find food. Last year, about half of the animals wearing satellite tags swam 240 miles round trip to Hannah Shoal.
We saw them making these extraordinary trips where they would travel far offshore for up to 2 weeks. They would go off and they would reoccupy these open sea conditions over the Hannah Shoals, and they would forage there intensively. And then they would do this long swim without foraging, just headed right back, get some rest, and go back and do it again. So this is a very novel behavior. Basically, they're commuting to get to the groceries.
USGS scientists are currently studying how costly that commute is for walruses. And it's likely an expensive trip. Instead of paying for gas, the animals are paying by expending more calories to reach their food. The land haulouts also leave calves vulnerable to trampling deaths when walruses get spooked by noise and stampede into the water. Rebecca Taylor is a researcher at USGS who co-authored a recent study that models how trampling deaths of young walruses might ultimately affect the population. She says the main takeaway is that calf deaths have a much bigger impact on the population than adult animals taken in subsistence harvest.
Calf trampling on a one walrus per one walrus basis, we expect it to have a greater effect on the population than harvest. And so that's something we need to be watching. And we need to be thinking about that.
In 2007, the first year walruses came to shore in Alaska and Russia, Russian biologists estimated that as many as 10,000 walruses died in trampling deaths, more than the annual harvest amount. Since then, wildlife managers and locals in both countries have worked to prevent the unnecessary deaths.
It made us aware of what we can do for the wildlife that we depend on.
Willard Nyakog is a resident of Point Lay and a member of the Alaska Eskimo Walrus Commission. Nyakog has helped lead an effort in Point Lay to make sure aircraft, boats, and even tourists don't disturb the walrus haulouts. He says the community has come together to protect the animals.
I'm sure that about 80% of our residents are also concerned about the mortality of young calves and the preservation of the walrus.
Nyakok says he's worried for the future of the species, and biologist Tony Fishbach says there is a reason for concern. But how much concern? Fishbach says that will require much more study in the years ahead. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the changing ecology of Chena Slough.
This used to be, you know, kind of like everybody's best place to go fishing, you know, from around town in Fairbanks. It was a great fishing spot.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
The danger of distracted driving is the target of a public outreach effort by a Fairbanks high school class. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Just Drive campaign is the product of technical writing students at West Valley High. Teacher Wendy Graham says the class worked with the State Department of Transportation to develop the outreach program, which began with a student survey that had some telling results.
70% have their phone within reach the entire time they're in the car. And they admitted to texting. They admitted to, surprisingly, the bigger numbers were music, because they know texting you're not supposed to do, but music is different, but you're still distracted and looking at your phones. So that's when we decided to make the campaign all of distracted driving and not just don't text.
Graham's students used the data to put together a press release, restaurant placemats, and an animated public service announcement about the risks of distracted driving. The outreach also includes school assemblies. At a West Valley event Tuesday, senior Chantel Smallwood shared a sobering statistic with an auditorium of students.
In the U.S., every weekend, 22 young people are killed in distracted driving-related accidents. So just to show this, can I have my two rows, the two front rows right here, just stand up for me? So this is how many people would die every weekend from distracted driving.
Federal data shows over 3,000 people were killed in distracted driving accidents in the U.S. in 2010. The West Valley presentation included an outside-produced graphic video about texting while driving that results in a deadly car crash. The audience went quiet as the reality of what can happen as the result of a range of distractions, which also include eating, applying makeup, and child care. Senior Corey Coolis, who worked on the Just Drive project, says it hit home.
Because myself, I've actually been distracted while driving, and I've almost had results that would have been consequential, you know. And I feel like a lot of the students and a lot of young adults are going to get the message.
State Department of Transportation spokeswoman Meadow Bailey praised the kids for spreading the word on a serious issue among their peers.
When students are speaking to other students, they're a lot more credible than a government agency or adults coming to them.
Students who attended Tuesday's assembly were invited to take a Just Drive pledge and given a thumb ring reminding them not to text at the wheel. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District hosted a public meeting in North Pole last night to talk about the changing ecology of Chena Slough. The slough is undergoing a long-term restoration project after biologists discovered the presence of an invasive aquatic plant and a serious decline in the Arctic grayling population. KUAC's Emily Schwing has more.
In the mid-1990s, the Army Corps of Engineers mapped Chena Slough to assess Arctic grayling habitat. Amy Larson is an aquatic ecologist with the National Park Service. She repeated that same study in 2011.
Since this project was done in 1997, there's been about a 29% to 30% reduction in the spawning and rearing habitat for Arctic grayling. This has largely been a result of vegetation encroaching into what once was riffles and pools habitat in the stream that had been previously unvegetated.
Larson works with Nick Lasuzzo. He's a biological science technician with the U.S. Forest Service. Lasuzzo says Chena Slough is historically one of the most productive streams for Arctic grayling in North America.
Prior to the 1960s, when Fairbanks was flooded and the subsequent development of the Chena Floodplain Project, Chena Slough is a side shoot of the Tanana River and had pretty fast flow. As a result, I think it had pretty good substrate for Arctic grayling spawning habitat.
The floodplain project cut the slough off completely from the Tanana River, so today it's fed only by groundwater. Not only did there used to be lots more water in the slough, it was also a lot more turbid. That means there were all kinds of tiny particles floating around in the water. Deep pools, riffles, and gravel along the bottom made excellent habitat for grayling. Nick Lasuzzo says the Chena Flood Project isn't the only reason grayling habitat has diminished.
One of the things that we think is likely contributing to that is the introduction of this non-native aquatic weed, Elodea.
Elodea was likely introduced to the slough within the last 10 to 15 years. It's taken over almost half of the lower 10 miles of the slough. Elodea can choke out other plant species. Amy Larson says it essentially creates its own habitat.
So basically the plant comes in, it grows, it slows down the water, it makes it more suitable for it to grow. It helps get the sediment out of the water, it makes the soil better for the plant to grow. So it just keeps, it's a positive feedback system. And so it's just going to continue to fill in the channel over time.
The Fairbanks Soil and Water Conservation District plans to use a suction dredge to start removing Elodea from the slough next summer. While the grayling population has decreased in recent years, both Lasuzzo and Larson say they haven't completely disappeared from Chena Slough.
I don't think it's a serious threat to the grayling population in the Chena River system itself. I think it's more of an issue of local recreational opportunities for residents of North Pole and the Fairbanks area.
Well, I mean, one of the things that has happened, you know, is that this used to be, you know, kind of like everybody's best place to go fishing, you know, from around town in Fairbanks. It was a great fishing spot, and people could readily go catch really nice-sized grayling pretty frequently. And so that's really changed over the years, and now people are having a harder time. They're having to spend a lot more time to catch any given fish. And also just the navigability of the stream has changed a lot. You just can't even paddle because there's so much vegetation in the slough.
Nick Lasuzzo says the long-term restoration of Chena Slough would be nearly impossible without the information collected by the Army Corps of Engineers.
You know, in 1997, when the Corps of Engineers and Fish and Game were addressing this problem, they actually made these really detailed habitat maps of the entire slough and archived their data and their methodology in pretty good detail. And so it's very rare that you have that before introduction data, that we were lucky enough to have that sort of information just laying on the bookshelf somewhere.
Lasuzzo and Amy Larson have submitted a manuscript of their work to the North American Journal of Fisheries Management for publication. I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. Era Alaska. For more than 30 years, Era Alaska has been transporting packages across the state, business documents, medical supplies, even family pets. More details at flyera.com or talk to your local Era Alaska agent. Era Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Soon, medical visits in the YK Delta could become simpler and possibly safer. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation is working on a new elaborate electronic health record system so village clinics and the hospital in Bethel can share patient information in moments. From KYUK in Bethel, Mark Earhart has more.
Dozens and dozens of people are using laptops inside an open room about half the size of a football field. They're working as a team testing out YKHC's electronic health record system. YKHC Chief of Staff Ellen Hodges says the system will greatly improve communication throughout the corporation and ultimately provide patients with better care.
So if a patient's in a village, that the doctor in Bethel can see the information that the health aide enters, and that I can transmit information to pharmacy and to the radiologists and so on and so forth. So just to make sure that all the pieces work together.
Currently, Hodges says, YKHC has an old-school health record system, literally pen and paper, files and folders.
This will completely eliminate all of that because it will all be available on the computer. And so the doctor in Bethel can just log onto the computer and have access to everything that's happened to the patient.
Hodges says this EHR system, which uses the internet to communicate, has been a long time in the making.
For the past year almost, we've been working on actually building the electronic health record from scratch.
But YKHC hasn't done it alone. They've had a lot of help from people like Mike Reeves.
In the old way of doing business, you had a illegible handwriting issue or an interpretation of the physician's handwriting issue that would be misinterpreted by a nurse. Well, that can't happen under the system.
Reeves is an executive from Cerner, the company out of Kansas City that's helping YKHC build their EHR system. He says the system will have automatic alerts that pop up if a patient is allergic to a drug or if two prescriptions would be dangerous if taken together.
You know, things like this are built into the system, which improves the overall quality of the health care provided.
Both Reeves and Hodges are seated at different tables in the room. Each table represents a department within the health corporation with furious testers trying to find glitches.
So, for example, at the physician table where I'm at, there's two physicians and then there's two Cerner employees who are our design consultants who are helping us get everything absolutely right.
YKHC plans on taking a few months to work out all the kinks before unveiling the system officially on January 28th. But when the EHR is finally rolled out, Howard says there is a backup system in case the electronic record goes down.
So we'll have a backup system that involves paper. So they'll be able to document, as they always have been, on paper and use phones to communicate with us.
In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
A businessman who spent millions of his company's money to build a cruise dock outside of Sitka 2 years ago will finally get his first regular customers. The Seven Seas Navigator and the Regatta have both announced plans to dock at Halibut Point Marine in 2013. For Chris McGraw, it means his wait for business is finally over, but the work of moving thousands of people is just beginning. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
The old Sitka dock is about 5 miles north of downtown Sitka, in a relatively industrial area of town. To get there, I drive out Halibut Point Road and turn left into a boatyard, avoiding the neighboring lot full of shipping containers and security warnings. I get out of my car near a giant travel lift that hauls boats out of the water for maintenance and repair. Chris McGraw is standing nearby.
How's it going?
You good?
Good.
McGraw is manager of Halibut Point Marine, which owns the dock.
Yeah, dimensions are 470 feet long, 55 feet wide, and the overall draws about 10 feet of water, and we have 8 feet sticking up, so it's 18 feet.
Giant black fenders have been pulled out of the water and sit near bollards where the ships will tie up. This floating concrete structure used to be part of Highway 520 in Washington State and carried commuters across Lake Washington between Bellevue and Seattle. Soon, it will carry tourists. The Seven Seas Navigator and the Regatta, both cruise ships already on Sitka's 2013 schedule, will use the dock instead of anchoring near downtown for the duration of the season.
The ships hold, I think, somewhere between 500 and 600 passengers, so it would range anywhere from 12,000 to 14,000.
Given the number of visits that they're going to make.
Yeah, it's depending on how many people are on the boat, you know, I don't know if they're always full or not, but they have 23 visits.
Yeah.
Supporters of using a dock say more passengers spend time in town when they can walk off the ship rather than having to take a smaller boat to shore. And they hope that translates into more business for downtown retailers and more sales tax revenue to the city. But there are also costs. Passengers will take a bus into town, and the city plans to pay $3 per head to the company that can provide the transportation. McGraw's firm plans to bid on the bus contract. The money will come from a per-passenger tax the state charges to cruise vessels and then passes along to municipalities. The cost to the city goes beyond cruise ship head tax money, though. The two ships together would have paid Sitka more than $16,000 to anchor and ferry passengers to shore at the O'Connell Bridge and Crescent Harbor. Now that they're using the dock, they'll be paying their fees to Halibut Point Marine, and it will probably be more than what they would have given the city. McGraw said the cruise ships will pay $3 a passenger to dock at Old Sitka, and that means up to $39,000 for Halibut Point Marine, provided every ship is fully loaded. And with that money, Halibut Point Marine will finally start to see income from the dock, which was built without any commitments from cruise companies.
We had thought that, we build the dock and why wouldn't they tie up? You know, you don't see them in Juneau, you know, anchoring up when there's empty dock space.
But McGraw says as a locally owned business, it was difficult to try to get the attention of international cruise lines.
You know their names and you have their phone numbers and their email addresses, but you can never get a hold of them and they never return your phone calls or your emails. And really, unless they want to talk to you, you don't get much FaceTime.
Just keep trying.
Keep trying. Persistence.
And it's paid off, apparently.
So. It's starting to, yes. Yeah.
Persistence might have been backed up by evidence. At the end of the 2012 season, the Celebrity Century tied up at Old Sitka. McGraw says that single visit showed other cruise lines that the dock is viable. In addition to the two ships planning to use Old Sitka in 2013, a Disney vessel has signed on for one visit in 2014. It will be the cruise line's first visit to Sitka. Disney will not ferry its passengers to shore, so without a dock, their ships would not visit at all. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
33-year-old Alaska Native artist Nicholas Galanin of Sitka has won a $50,000 fellowship for artistic excellence. The National Artists Advocacy Organization, United States Artists, or USA, awarded Galanin the USA Rasmussen Fellowship in the Crafts and Traditional Arts category. The group announced the 54 grant recipients, who included visual artists, writers, and musicians, on Monday in Los Angeles. Galanin grew up watching his father create art, and after he graduated high school, the 18-year-old decided to become an artist full-time. He was working for the National Park Service at the Russian Bishop's House and was told that during his downtime, he couldn't draw, but had to read books on Russian history.
From that point on, that I'm going to do what I love. I'm going to do it passionately. I feel great and alive and invested in my time, and I feel like I'm investing it wisely.
Galanin combines the traditional and contemporary in his work. USA has awarded $17.5 million to America's most innovative artists in the past 7 years. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Mark Earhart in Bethel, and Ed Ronco and Ann Bryce in Sitka. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. And by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. Get a career in less than a year in nursing or QMed or professional cooking and baking. Additional programs and course information online at avtech.edu. Classes in Seward and Anchorage start in January, so enroll now. This message sponsored by Avtech. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.